There's no music because I can't afford it right now, but there will be soon. Welcome to another live edition of Security Guy Radio and SecurityGuyTV.com right here at the beautiful Sunset Gower Studios in Hollywood. And today, I'm very excited to have a very special friend of mine, a special guest, Mr. Terrence Stern. Now, he's going to talk about his new book. It's University Sheepdog in Westwood, LA. I would have dropped the comma if I was editor, but it's a really good book anyway. Terry, hand me that book. Let me take
there
a look.
Go.
Yeah, let me show everybody the book. It's really good. Let me pull my graphics off here. Now, this is it right here. You guys can see it. It's an excellent book, 600 pages. So let's spend no more time, and let's welcome my special guest, Mr. Terrence Stern. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Harold.
How you been?
For allowing me to come on your show.
It's been a long time.
I'm blessed.
A long time.
Yes.
So we worked together at UCLA way back in the day. I started in 89. You started in 88. Right?
Correct. Yes.
That's a long time ago. But we both look marvelous.
Yes,
we both
do.
Look about the same, don't we?
Exactly. We do.
I have gray hair. You still have no hair.
I just shave it. That's all.
So tell us about UCLA. I mean, UCLA is the University of California. It's under the UC system. People don't understand that that's a separate police department. It's full state powers, state police powers. You're a police officer full time, right?
Correct.
But it reports to the University of California, which is very unique. So tell us how that structure works.
Well, when you and I joined, it was 9 campuses. Now it's 10. Merced was just admitted just a few years ago. And each department, each campus has a police department. Is we are University of California.
Right.
But each campus police department is separate, has its own entity, has its own police chief. And once a year, they rotate the super chief's job. And this person, there's a chief, they say at UCLA, he assumed the duties of being the chief of chiefs in the UC systems. But there is actually, really, there's no chief of police of the University of California Police. Each campus has their own chief of police.
Yeah, kind of interesting.
And that police chief reports to the chancellor or the vice chancellor and that sort of thing.
Of each campus.
Of each campus, correct.
Right. Uh-huh. And you were at UCLA and worked under that chief. Well, several chiefs, actually.
Several chiefs,
yeah,
yes.
I had a long career. I didn't last that long. And they get their power from the regents of the University of California.
Actually, this power is 830.2 of the Penal Code.
That's right.
That gives us a statewide jurisdiction. And then there's another educational code which further defines University of California Police. The state gives us statewide jurisdiction, but our primary role is defined in the California Education Code that we are to concentrate our authority as police officers on the campus and a mile around each of the campus or the properties owned and operated by the regents of the University of California. But as you know, the regents of the University of California are pretty huge landowners. So you put circles around each property,
right?
It'll basically cover the state.
Well, it really does.
Yes.
You may recall from my shenanigan days at UCLA when I started Bruin Watch. Remember that?
Yes, I remember.
And
I
found out they had 1,500 properties. They were the second highest property owner in the state next to the federal government.
Yes.
So, yeah, in L.A., we had between UCLA and Marina Del Rey, and we covered the whole area. So.
We covered area, and there's some places where it's just too far out that we just couldn't cover.
Right, right.
You know, so it's one time I remember I was sitting on a Code 3 call because it was a fire alarm. I didn't know where I was going, so as I'm flying through the streets of Los Angeles, our dispatchers are giving me direction, and we didn't have cell phones at the time. We had those MapQuest books. So we had a dispatcher was telling me
the Thomas Guide.
So I remember that very fondly. But that just, again, illustrates some of its properties that the University of California owns. And we basically cover the areas roughly around within 20 miles of the campus.
Yeah. Now, let's start with your background. I'd kind of like to go through this chronologically. Okay. Tell us, kind of where you grew up and how you became a police officer and your military service. Very interesting.
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles. I was born in 59. I was born in Cleveland, and my mother, my family migrated out here in about 60 or 61. So I was raised in Los Angeles in Inglewood area. Graduated from high school in 78, joined the Marine Corps 78 to 82. Subsequently, I went into the Marine Corps Reserve from 85 to 91. I was recalled for the first Gulf War.
Oh.
Okay, for now, when to become, how to become a police officer. Well, like a lot of young black men or young men in general, I didn't particularly care for the police when I was growing up
right. In
Los Angeles and in Inglewood. Matter of fact, I even had a relative who was shot and killed by a highway patrol officer back in September 1975. What changed my opinion was when I went overseas. I was stationed in Okinawa, and I remember when we arrived overseas, our commanding officer told us not to mess with the Japanese police, or the JPs. That's what we call them, short. Because there's no concept of police brutality in that culture.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they told you basically is this. It's very disciplined culture, the Japanese culture.
And right.
So if someone of authority told you to do something, you do it. And I remember one incident. There was a bunch of drunken Marines outside of a bar in Kenville, outside of our camp at Camp Hansen, Okinawa. And one of the bar maidens came out and said, I'm going to call JPs. Well, these Marines hightailed it back to the base. And I couldn't help but think at the time, if someone said, this was Los Angeles, and they said, we're going to call LAPD, these people wouldn't have left that quickly. And remember, this is back in 1980, when the homicide rate in L.A. was like up to about 1,000 a year.
Oh, I think it was more maybe. It was crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy at the time. So people weren't afraid of the police, you know. So, but here I am in Japan, and all this person to say, I'm called JPs. But it took some time for the Marines to understand, the group of Marines that I was with, because about 3 months prior to that incident, It was a drunken Marine, and he refused to leave a bar when the Japanese police told him. They asked him twice. Third time, they took a baton and hit him inside his head, and then he dragged him to a local jail, and he stayed for about a week. That got the message that you don't mess with the Japanese police.
Right.
So that basically started to change my opinion of the American police.
Now, how so?
Well, again, there in when I was in Japan, is they didn't hesitate to hit you, you know. Now, granted, they gave you a warning,
right.
You know, but there was no hue and cry. There's no such thing as he brutalized. No, and you were told by our command, you will obey the Japanese police, and they really put it
direct order, right.
You know, and so if someone got hit. You know, by the Japanese police, there was no lawsuits. There was no IA, you know, internal affairs. No, particularly the Japanese police tell you, you do something, you go back to base, you do this and that. So that basically.
Now, was that extreme? If it got to the point where they smacked you,
yeah. You
were really out of line? Was that your perception?
That's my perception, particularly after they told you, they gave you a fair warning. And if you didn't do what they told you to do, like this Marine at the bar, he was asked several times, to leave, and
right.
He wouldn't leave, and that's what he took out this baton and hit him. You know, some Marines got upset about it. Then more Japanese police arrived on scene, and then they started using their batons. How one young Marine described it. They started using batons on these jarheads, so to speak. So now fast forward to that incident when the bar maiden said, "I'm gonna call JPs." It was already set in stone that. You do what the Japanese police tell you to do. So this woman's telling you she calling the JPs, then you go back to the base. So, and we went back to the base.
Now, what did you do in the service? Were you military police, or what was your...
I was a 2531, which is a field radio operator. I was assigned to infantry, so I was a battery operator grunt. Some of the Marines out there, they don't know what I'm talking about. When I was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment down at Camp Pendleton, and there's a sub base called Camp Margarita that I went overseas.
Camp Margarita.
Yeah. Remember Margaritaville?
Yeah.
The song?
Yeah.
Wasting away again to Margaritaville. That was our unofficial song because it came out at that time in 1979.
Oh, interesting. All right.
So we used to sing that, particularly when we get that up one part. Wasting away again to Margaritaville. And it's my own damn fault, you know, why were we in this position. But anyway, it was good times. Also, a lot of discipline. I learned a lot in the Marine Corps, and I'm very thankful that I went in. But when I got out in 82, I needed a job. I knew I didn't want to make the Marine Corps a career. So you may find this surprising, but I wanted to become an accountant.
I do find that surprising.
Exactly. I wanted to be an accountant. So I wanted to start off as a bookkeeper. So Santa Monica, There was a school in Santa Monica. I had to remember. Now, we're talking like 34 years ago now.
Gets a little vague, doesn't it? Starts to get a little fuzzy.
My goodness gracious. So I started applying for this one class for become a bookkeeper. So I figured I'd be a bookkeeper first, and I'd go back to school and build my way up to be an accountant. At the same time, my cousin, I don't think he wouldn't mind me calling him, Darrell Hurt, he was a police officer. He was a reserve police officer for the city of Riverside. And he worked full-time. He had a full-time job, and he worked as a reserve police officer. And he was about to get married. So I was going to be his best man. So I went to where he was living at the time. At the time, he was Rialto. And he said, why don't you come on a ride-along? So I went on a ride-along a night before he got married. And remember, I'm 22, and he's 21. So he's very gung-ho about being a police officer. And I rode around with this one officer, and we connected because he was in the Air Force. Even though he was Air Force, but he was still prior military. And he didn't think about being a police officer when he was in the military.
And you didn't either.
I didn't either. Never crossed my mind.
Interesting.
Never crossed my mind. He worked in construction. And he said he went to a donut. Well, funny, right? He went to a Winchell's donut shop. He saw these cops. And he said, I could do that. He said,
eat donuts. Drink coffee, yeah. That's right.
That's his words, not mine. Right. So don't get angry at me. So he started applying, and he got on with Riverside. He says, and at the time, he had 5 years on the job. And he said basically this, you know, I worked construction. So when I used to come home from construction, I was absolutely filthy. You know, I come home from working this job, I could just go to the fridge, open up a cold one, sit down on the sofa, and, you know, not worry about taking a shower.
So donuts and clean refrigerators was the nexus of your ability and reason to join the police.
No. What happened was with the ride-along, he was just telling me what got him started.
Yeah.
But I'm listening to him and the calls that we were going on, and this one particular call, it was a 459. Well, I didn't know what a 459 was.
That's a burglary.
Burglary at the time, right? And Riverside, you know, it's pretty far. It's a pretty large city, and there's some rural areas in Riverside. So we went to this one house. It kind of reminded me of Mockingbird Lane. Remember that?
From the Monsters.
The Monsters.
Yeah.
It kind of resembled that, you know. And it was night, and it was windy. And these officers all arrived. It was about three cars. And the officer I was with, he was, you know, just by himself. But the other two police cars had two officers, so it was five officers there. But I was told to stand behind, stay in the car. And they went to the home, and they started searching around, and then they went in, guns drawn. That motivated me. Because you got to remember, I just came out of the Marine Corps, Esprit de Corps, working together.
Right.
I was with the infantry, even though I was a radio operator. I went on squad tactics with them, and I connected with this. And then around 3 o'clock in the morning, all the officers again went to a donut shop just to they could write their reports. And these guys, they had a connection; they were very tight with one another. And right then and there, I said, "This is what I want."
That's it, right there. Yeah. Isn't it? That's the secret. There's really no job like it. This connection, this brotherhood, sisterhood, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's quite different than most professions.
Yeah,
I think it's even more different. I think it's more different than even police. I mean, even maybe fire or nurses, which are similar. But I don't know, something about the police. It's just you're protecting somebody's life every day. Yours first, and then your buddies.
Exactly. Right? And one of the guys I remember, you remember this is 82,
right?
And automatics was just now coming into play for the police officers. Because most officers at the time had
I had a wheel gun. I had a wheel gun in 82,
But anyway, this one officer got into a shootout. He was one of the first officers to have the automatic. It fell apart on him.
Oh, no.
So he's laughing. He's laughing as he's telling the story. And I'm sitting there looking at him. Are you kidding me? You know, I would have been mortified. You know, if my weapon fell apart. But he took it as a joke, mainly because the incident happened just a few years prior, and he survived it, and the suspect was apprehended. But I'm looking at these guys, and they just close this bond right here because, you know, they out there protecting the city. And again, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and the call started, the volume started to die down, and you know, and they all got together for about maybe 30 minutes, had a cup hot chocolate, coffee, whatever, bite, and went back out, you know, to the streets, you know, esprit de corps, you know,
right.
And so when I, the next day when my cousin got married, it actually played in my mind about being a police officer for the first time. I couldn't believe it. So when I came home to talk to my mother, first thing she said was, "Really?" When I said, I said, "Mom, I'm thinking about becoming a cop now." She said, "Really?" And then she remembers my days as a youth.
Right.
You know.
Not uncommon, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, for guys that were, you know, borderline, you know, backstreet boys or bad by, you know.
I wasn't a bad kid, though. I'm a
bad kid. No, I know. But, yeah. I mean, you know, listen, there is a fine line between a police officer and a criminal.
Yes.
Very similar personalities.
Right.
You know, so this it's just something about this way you look at life and you do things and get things done, yeah.
But there was one incident, you're not going to believe me, but I was taken into custody when I was about 13 years old, and I had a weapon on me, and they never searched me.
Oh, no, I believe that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't search me.
No, I got some stories about weapons. I know.
Yeah.
That's true. Now, you went to, so what was your first department then?
First department was Long Beach Police.
Oh,
back
Long Beach,
in, back in 1983.
Okay.
All right. But let me go back into with the kid. As I was a kid, I don't know, people, he had a weapon. Why is that?
Right.
The reason why, because I was jumped by some Crips back in, this is the early 70s. And I figured, this is not going to happen to me again, you know. So what I did was, I had a Levi jacket, Eisenhower Levi jacket. I sewed a pocket into my jacket, and I had a dog, and I took a his leather strap, leash, and I sawed off the handle, and I hammered it into a wisp broom handle, which was maybe about 16 inches long.
Right.
And I put that into my jacket pocket. So one night I came home, and my mother owned her own business, and she left a note telling me she wanted me to get some milk and bread. I bet I'll turn my behind to the store real quick, because she was coming home late. So I'm running to the store, and I get stopped by LAPD. You know, it's about 10:15, something like that, for curfew. Long story short, basically, I mouthed off. And they called me a stud and turned me around, handcuffed me, put me back in the patrol car. And now I'm sitting in the patrol car with my hand behind my back, and I have this billy club in my jacket. And they take me down to the old Wilshire station. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, the old wooden station.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So old wooden station.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
And they handcuffed me to a bench, okay? And guys are making comments, is he a Crip or a Brim? There wasn't Bloods then. It was Brims.
Right.
Brims. And as I'm sitting there, the handle comes out, and I'm start doing this with my hands behind my back.
Oh, because you're cuffed, right?
I'm cuffed, yeah. Right. So I'm doing this to try to get the handle back into my jacket. And it, guys watching over me, it goes back. They didn't book me in. They didn't write me a citation. They called my mother. My mother came pick me up. And the look on my mother's face right then and there, when she come pick me up from the police station, I will never forget that look. And I made a promise right then and there that I would never have my mother come pick me up from the police station again. You know, and she, 9 years later, I was in the police academy.
9 years. Well, that's good.
Yeah. Ain't that something?
Now, your book, does it touch on Long Beach?
It touches on Long Beach, yes.
But the juicy parts, the really interesting stuff is
UCLA.
UCLA and Westwood, right?
Exactly.
So tell us how the book's laid out.
Well, it starts off with my officer-involved shooting that I was involved in. I go into some details about the incident in which I ended up having to shoot a homeless man. We fought over my weapon. I was disarmed. As you know, as a police officer, if you lose your weapon in a fight, you know, you're in a fight for your life.
That's right.
You know, I managed to get it back from him, and I shot him twice. Okay, I go into real details into the book.
Yeah. And this was kind of a big deal at the time, kind of an infamous case and everything, right?
Oh, yeah. I got some airplay.
Yeah.
You know. at the time. I go into detail about, you know, going to see a police psychologist, and then investigated. I go up by the investigation.
Right.
Not just by our department, but also by the district attorney, the DA investigators. They come and investigate you also.
Sure.
You know, and how I was cleared, you know, and that sort of thing. So once I get done with the officer-involved shooting chapter, and that's when I go into me growing up. And I go into pretty detail of my life growing up with my mother in Los Angeles, and growing up, my first kiss, that sort of thing. High school I went through, almost getting kicked out of school for fighting, and how my mother had to come back and basically threaten the principal if they kicked me out because I was defending myself. And I'm very thankful for my mother now, because that's almost 40 years ago. Because had they kicked me out of school, that would have been on my record, you know?
Right, right.
You know, and since I wasn't kicked out of school, it wasn't on my record. And I had my mother to thank for that, you know?
Now, it's interesting. Yeah. I like going into your background. Yeah. And if people looked into all cops' backgrounds, they'd see something that was some kind of catalyst, something that kind of launched them or pushed them that way or something. And I think it's significant that people, and I've heard the story before. I mean, I don't think I really woke up and said I want to be a policeman. I thought about it, but like you, I just kind of had a revelation one day that was the right thing to do. It's
exactly.
A weird, I don't know how to describe it, a weird revelation that it was just something I should be doing. It would be fun, be the right thing to do. You know, did you have something like that when you just kind of said I should do it? I mean, I know you said you do it because you like donuts and stuff, but I mean, really, the other reason was, you know, it's just like, you know, that seems like the job. That's the career. That's the life choice, right? It's a
big thing. That was a choice because, again, you know, military background. And again, I didn't think anything about being a police officer until I went on a ride-along and how close these guys were.
Yeah.
You know, and esprit de corps.
And then you went to UCLA and found out differently.
Well, you know, even though our command staff, some of them were bozos, you know, I'm not going to say no names.
I have insurance, I can't, but I won't.
Yeah, but you know, some you look at any department, you will hear an officer say their command staff, some of them have bozos in it.
Well, they have to promote them because if they didn't, they'd get in trouble
in
the field.
They get in trouble in the field, exactly. But at the same time, I work with good people like you.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true. We had good people.
We had good people, regardless of the shenanigans was going on.
Well, it's the politics of police work that people don't understand. Yeah. That makes it a not fun profession.
Yeah,
but
particularly
now. Yeah, the guys like each other, and we get along. We have a lot of fun. And then some sergeant who doesn't know anything about it comes in, and he cocks everything up, right? It's just it's a big mess.
Exactly.
Which is why we had a giant lawsuit that was in the paper, and you can look it up. That's not in the book, but give us some of your favorite chapters. Tell us some stories. We want to hear some of these great stories.
Well,
by the way, just real quick, we can get the book on Amazon. We can get it on Google Books.
Google's.
In, a lot of different places.
E-books.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I go into different chapters. The chapter that I really describe of me becoming a police officer is called The Man. Now, remember, The Man, particularly in the black culture, is not just a white man. It's just someone who's in authority.
Right.
You know? And The Man had different connotations in the black community. If you're in the South, any white man's the man. When you got into the North and to the West, it was finer defined because in the South, the man could have been any drunken white man. And, you know, particularly, you know, during Jim Crow era, if you were walking down the street and the white man was walking past, you better step off the curb and let this man, I don't care if he's a derelict.
Right.
You know, you have to show reverence to this man. Now, you go further up North, not necessarily had to step off the curb, but there was one universal figure of the man, and that was a uniformed police officer. You know, and
no matter what color it was.
No matter what, exactly. You were the man, okay? And I go into details about, because in the 1960s, during the civil rights era movement, and my first impressions of the man was during the 65 riots. You know, I remembered the police, even though I was 5 years old. You know, when you are young, there's images that's burned into your memory, you know. And I remember seeing uniformed men who were in green uniform. I knew they were soldiers, and they had rifles, and they had a long knife. Now I know it was a bayonet at the end of there. So I remember that, and I remember seeing uniformed police officers with the white helmets. If you remember, at the time, LAPD wore white helmets, black and white helmets at the time. So that steered into my memory banks. But as I grew up, I had an officer actually save me from some Crips about to jump me, and it was Inglewood. I was living in Inglewood. Guy stops the car, and as I was going home, and he wanted, I'm not going to use the words that he was saying, but he wanted to know, you know, what kind of money did I have for him. I didn't have no money. I was thinking about kicking him in the groin, but I realized there was three other knuckleheads in the car, so if I fought him, I had to fight all of them, so I'm thinking about running across the street, you know. This is on Manchester Boulevard, I think it was in Inglewood. But anyway, at the same time, a plane wrapped police unit comes up, and these grim-faced police officers get out the car, and they knew this guy by name, you know. So then it starts changing, but I never thought about being a cop then. Again, I didn't start thinking about becoming a cop until after the ride along with my cousin.
Right.
So that's the man. Then I go into Hard Knocks and Recovery, and that's when I become a police officer. I named it there because my first police agency was Long Beach Police, and unfortunately I didn't make probation there.
Oh, okay. I didn't make. Well, by the way, not uncommon. Yeah, nothing to get excited about. Happens.
Exactly. It happens, right? Another thing too, I had an evaluation that was sort of signed, and I told my field training officer that I wasn't going to sign it. Now you know what happens.
I had a couple of those, I must say. Yeah.
I said, "Well, I don't believe this is an accurate description of what occurred tonight." He looked at me. He said, "Rookie, you're going to pay for this." And man, did I pay.
Yeah.
You know, I paid for it. In hindsight, I wish I had signed the damn thing, you know.
Well,
but you know something? I've been blessed. Maybe it was a good thing that I didn't sign it. I just stayed with Long Beach Police. Nothing against Long, don't get me wrong. But maybe it just wasn't for me in that department.
Right.
Because right now, I'm retired. I have a good pension, you know, and I'm blessed. You know, and I've got to meet you, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here.
It's a it's a culture, right? So. Right. Each department has personality.
Exactly.
And sometimes a cop's personality doesn't match that department. That doesn't mean it doesn't match another one. So that's fine. I worked at three. I blended into three. That was unusual.
Yeah.
Some guys do two.
Right.
So it's not a bad thing necessarily, right? People have to understand that if you don't make one department, that doesn't mean you're not a good police officer.
Exactly. You know. So I was asked to resign.
And which is nice of them.
Yeah,
instead of firing you, because they understand you can go work somewhere else.
Exactly. But as I said, I said I ain't resigning nothing, and so they fired me.
Oh well, okay. Well, there's a different part of the story.
So they fired me. So I went to work as a reserve officer for the city of Pasadena.
Oh, okay.
And that's when I really learned how to be a police officer. You know, with that department, and they put me with some good, fantastic street cops. You know, who got the job done. And I was able to jail with them. Again, I was a reserve.
Right.
So I worked three or four days out the month, non-pay. I did an 8 or 9 hour tour, and they stuck me with a police officer. You know, I was in a blue uniform. You couldn't tell. Only way you could tell that I was a reserve officer was the badges was 500 series. But it wasn't nothing.
A reserve officer is a full-time police officer.
Yeah, when they're on duty. Yeah, you're full-time.
Right.
So I worked undercover. I went and did some buy bust. Buy bust is when buy bust is when they're street dealers, and you drive up as an undercover and you purchase narcotics. I learned to work undercover as a reserve police officer. But as a reserve, again, you're not getting paid. And I had two jobs. I was working at Hawthorne Mall, Plaza Security, and the Bel Air Patrol. At the time, the gangs were thriving. And Hawthorne gangs wanted to take over the Hawthorne Mall.
That was a rough mall, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. I got into more fights.
Yeah.
You know, working in that mall, you know, than I ever did as a police officer. Mainly because they looked at us being, you know,
right.
Mall cops, you know. But I worked with most of the guys I worked with became cops later. You know, they held our, we had no other choice but to hold our own. We weren't armed, you know, and we had to fight. We had to let the gangs know, no, you cannot take over. You're not going to take over the mall with us here. So I went to, after about 18 months as a reserve officer, I went to El Camino College Police, which is located in Torrance.
Right.
You know, Torrance. I think it's one of the largest or the largest JC.
I think it is the largest one or something
in
like that.
In the West Coast,
right,
in that area. So I worked there for about 2 years and then decided I needed to go to a bigger department. So I applied for LAPD, Sheriff's Department, and then you may find it strange. An LAPD lieutenant told me I should apply for UCLA also. I said, I'm not going to apply for no more campuses. No, he says different. It's different.
It's different, all right. It's different, all right. That's for sure.
Remember.
Is he playing a practical joke on you or something?
Remember Joe Aries?
Yes, I remember Joe Aries. Yeah.
Okay, he did. You know, he was a king of sting.
Right.
Now, again, before I thought about it, actually, when I was thinking about becoming a police officer, 60 Minutes did a piece on Joe Aries. I don't even remember. This is back in 82 or 83. Of the stings that he was doing.
And no, he had a very good reputation.
He has a very good reputation. So he brought this LAPD lieutenant brought this up to me, right? So I said, okay, let me go apply. And I went on a ride along with Jack Shepard. Now, Jack Shepard, Jack Shepard was an officer that, second to none, he knew the streets. And he told me, the good parts of working for UCPD, and some bozos. He let me know, hey, we got some.
Well, like at any department.
You know, he just let me. I said, look, there was bozos that, you know, when I was at Pasadena, you know, a lot of respect for the officers there. And I went on, and when I went on my ride-alongs with those officers, they used to talk about the command staff at the time, you know. So what he was telling me was nothing uncommon. But he told me some good things. He explained that it was at the time, again, it was like 9 campuses. We have a full authority. And he said, you will like it here. And you can do a lot here. You know, it's a good department for a merit man. You know,
so now, tell some stories.
Yeah.
There was the Nation of Islam story.
Yes.
There was the, what was the other infamous story about you?
I have so many.
Tell us a couple of those stories. I think people want to read these in the book, but I mean, just kind of give us a good.
Well, you brought up the Nation of Islam incident. In that chapter is called "Bad Situation."
Okay.
Remember the song by Public Enemy called "Fight the Power."
Yep.
And when it was 19, it started off 1989. Another number. Get down, brothers and sisters. Well, my incident occurred in 1989, and first off, I was on campus. It's around twilight, and I do a traffic stop. And as I'm doing the traffic stop, I'm hearing some cadence.
Right.
You know, up, left, right, left. And I hear, platoon, halt.
It's on campus.
On campus, right. Over there by faculty center.
Yep.
Okay. Right. And I turn around, and I see these uniformed young men, all black, and these black paramilitary uniform with a beret, and there's a gentleman in the traditional garb of the Nation of Islam with the bow tie. I knew right then and there, I said, these guys must be the fruit of Islam. Now, if you know the fruit of Islam, these guys are trained martial artists, and most of it's Kempo, okay? So I'm thinking, okay, and I also know some of the stories of what happened between cops and the Nation. Back in the early 70s, two NYPD officers were dispatched. They know it was a phony call to a mosque, but it didn't look like a mosque. It just looked like a home in Harlem. And these officers goes into the mosque, and they climb up the steps because it was a dispatch of an officer needs help, officer down. Once they got into the building, they realized they were in trouble. So they tried to do a beef. They tried to do a retreat. And they slammed the door on these two officers, and they beat the holy mess out of these guys. One officer managed to escape. Other one didn't. He was disarmed, and he was shot and killed with his weapon. Okay. There was another incident with the Nation of Islam with LAPD back in the early 60s in which officers were beat, and they killed. They shot several NOI guys. And there was an incident in Inglewood in which an Inglewood officer was beat up. And he was handcuffed to his patrol car, you know. So I knew of these stories, and I think, do I call for backup.
These are the guys who used to hang out at Fatburger, right? Put their little
bow ties. But see, there's a difference. Those guys are not a fruit of Islam. Those guys are probably like privates in the army.
All right.
But if you're a fruit of Islam, you're being trained to defend the property of the nation of Islam.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. And they're very well disciplined, okay? And I think they do more training than the average cop, okay?
Interesting.
Right. So I'm about to write this young lady a citation, and they stopped because she was black. And they wanted to watch her, even though I'm black. I'm in the uniform of the man.
You're the man. That's right.
I'm the man, you know. So therefore, even though I'm black, I'm the man, you know. So I figured I'm not going to call for a backup. Even with a backup, it's not enough. You're going to have to call West LA.
Well, maybe it'll escalate it too.
Yeah, exactly. So I figured just to play it cool. And this young lady sees what's happening, and she starts boo-hooing, real, "Don't write me a ticket, please." For that, I'm writing her a citation. So I went back to my car. I wrote her a citation, and then the commander of the group says, "Lay up, face forward, march," and they start marching away. I go back. Her demeanor changed. "You lucky that they didn't come get you." Whatever. Sign a citation. She signed the citation. Boom. 90 minutes later, I'm in Westwood at Gailey. There used to be a gas station at Gailey and Wilshire. There used to be a gas station there.
Right.
Okay. If you remember correctly, back in the days, there was an alley behind the Gailey Center, and you turn left into the gas station area into Gailey.
Right.
So I'm driving down the alley. I turn left, and there's a car blocking the roadway. So I shine my spotlight at the driver, and there's no one's moving. He's not moving. So I spot it again. So I put the overheads on. I'm going to get out the car. I'm going to go talk with these guys. As soon as I get out the car, the driver gets out the car. He gets out, and he goes. He stands like this with his feet shoulder length apart, knees slightly bent, arms bent, and his fist by his groin area. Okay,
this is a stance of aggression.
Exactly.
Right.
And he says, "What do you want?" I said, "I need you to get back in the car." I could see that he's the same guy. Well, he's part of the same group that I saw earlier.
Only 90 minutes earlier.
Oh, 90 minutes earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
So there's three other guys in the car. So he's standing like this, and he says, "What do you want? I'm not getting back in the car. Get back in the car, please. I need you to get back in the car." As he's standing right there, I see the car doors opening, and I know, uh-oh, I'm not going to let these guys get out the car. So I pull out my gun. You remember, I had a six-shooter. This is 1989. So I pull up my gun, and I order, "Everybody stay in the car. Stay in the car." But I use some other expletives. "Stay in the effing car," okay? As this was going on, there was a van to my left. Next thing you know, the van doors open, and these guys came out in black pair of military uniforms, like the Marines hitting
the same
beach.
Guys from before?
Same guys from before. It's like Marines hitting the beach.
Right.
Okay? And they're coming up, and they're screaming at me, "Put that gun down, pig. Put that gun down, pig. Are you Uncle Tom? You afraid of us?" And I'm like, uh-oh. The next thing I looked over, and there see some more Nation of Islam guys, but in the traditional bow ties, right across the street. So I'm ordering everybody to stay put. And these guys getting out the car, so they still getting out the car, and they still get out the car, and they take the position. And next thing you know, they're in the position, you know, in a fighting stance. And I got about 10 or 15 guys to my left in the fighting stance starting to approach me.
And you're by yourself still?
I am by myself with a six shooter. So I had to put on an act as if I'm crazy.
Well, that wasn't too hard, was it?
Oh, no, it wasn't. So I was able to just to basically play myself. So I pointed the gun directly at the driver, the person that I originally contacted. I said, you're going to die. You are going to die. And his eyes widened. That told me right then and there that he's human. You know, he was afraid to die. I saw the fright in his eye. Then I realized that I haven't called for a backup, so I wouldn't as I put my six-shooter into my left hand, I grabbed the microphone, and I put out, "Officer needs help. Officer needs help. Galea Wilshire at the gas station." I think it was a 76. I can't remember now. And I'm keeping him at gunpoint. Luckily, remember Dave Behrens?
Sure, Dave Behrens,
yeah. Yeah, Dave. He showed
his arms were bigger than my legs.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. It's a true story.
Yeah, but back in 89, Dave was, you know, he was pretty husky. Right, you right. know, pretty husky. And then his partner, it was another Dave. They arrive. And when I wrote the story, I actually called Dave because, you know, he's retired now. Dave got out of his car, racked his shotgun, and you could just hear, you know, and he put it in the cuff of his bicep because Dave was on the street, on the corner, on the curb, him and his partner, and I had the Nation of Islam right there, and then I had the car in front. Then I got on the radio to tell, "Hey, guys, watch out. There's more Nation guys behind, you know, on the street." So more officers arrive, and it was a miniature standoff. And two, one of the sergeants, I'm not going to say her name, she arrived on scene, and she actually walked past the Nation. She got into she was really ridiculed for her action. She walked up to me, asked me, was I okay? She went back to the Nation, one of the supervisors there, and negotiated, and they allowed me to write the citation.
Oh, they allowed you. How nice of them.
Yes.
I didn't realize they gave those permits.
Yeah, gave up. You know, I was 29 years old at the time, former Marine. I went, these guys need to go to jail, you know. But she said, no, just write the citation. So I wrote the citation, and the guys were saying, "And when the revolution comes, I'll be the first one to die," and you know, all that good stuff, right? So a citation was written. He signed it. He was about to put down an X, and I told him, "No, you're going to put your name on this thing." So he grudgingly put his name, got in the car, and everyone left. What's so interesting about this, remember the story, Enter the Dragon, the movie Enter the Dragon?
Right.
Okay. Jim Kelly, Bruce Lee. Now, in the series, in the movie, there's a scene in which Jim Kelly gives his sensei a hug before he goes to Hong Kong. Okay, and that sensei, his name was Steve Sanders. Steve Sanders was a martial artist, and even Bruce Lee said that he had the world's fastest hands. Steve Sanders became Steve Muhammad. He joined the Nation of Islam. Guess who trained those men that I had a confrontation with?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. He came to the station 2 days after the incident. Remember Terry Baker?
Sure.
Okay. Terry Baker knew him because he used to train him, you know. So he figured, why don't we just have a dialogue? So this man comes to the station, and I see him. He's wearing a Marine Corps hat. He's a black man. Small stature, but you can see he's determined. So he comes, and he's walking in the station. He goes directly to the chief's office. Your friend, John Barber.
Yes.
Take a little swig, if you don't mind.
For our podcast listeners, Terry was drinking water, in case you wanted that sound effect. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so he stays in the chief's office for about 20 minutes. He comes out, and chief says, "Hey, Terry, he'd like to talk with you, if you don't mind." I got no issues. So there was an empty office. So I sat in the empty office with Steve Muhammad and Terry Baker. Now, again, Steve Muhammad started the BKF, the Black Karate Federation, which trained young black, particularly young black men, to fight in the karate martial arts tournaments. And he was a bad, can I say a badass?
You can say anything you want on Security Guy TV. That's correct.
He was considered truly a badass. He also a former Marine, and he served as a pathfinder. And to be a pathfinder in the Marine Corps, you have to have your stuff together, you know. And he was there in Vietnam before the escalation of 65. So he was there, you know, advising as an advisor. So he may have been around the block, you know. So he's sitting right across from me, and he asked me what happened. And he's looking at me dead in the eye. I said, "Well, sir, your men, one of the men got out of the car, and I told him to get back in the car. And he took a fighting stance. And as I was telling him to get back, other guys started to get out." He said, "Well, one reason why people were upset because you pulled a gun. I said, I pulled my gun because I saw the car doors opening. I said, I'm not. I said, I was alone. I used
the. No, you need to get shot first before you can pull your gun.
Yeah, right. You know, and I said, look here, no, these guys were getting out the car, and I didn't want them to get out the car, and I had to let them know. I was like a lone Marine in a foxhole all by myself. And he kind of looked at me like, you know, he understood that statement. But long story short with that, after we had a discussion, he said, look here, we don't want any problems. I said, I don't want any problems. So we basically shook hands, you know. So in the future, when I saw the nation, they used to look at me and it's not a, well, prob got, I'm nodding my head.
Well, but only because they got orders from somebody, right? Not because they.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They got orders, yeah. But you know, bear with me, same story basically. About a month later, remember the big fight at 43rd and Crenshaw between LAPD and the Nation of Islam? Remember that incident?
Yeah.
It was same guys.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. Okay. I found that out later. But me and Larry Luther were riding together, and we heard it was on Crenshaw Boulevard and 43rd Street. And they said, well, we're stopping and roll some units. Get us a backup. What happened was some LA officers stopped the car full of Nation. These guys are coming back from training. They were in a black preliminary uniform. I guess one of the guys had a warrant. LA was going to try to make an arrest. They tell them, you ain't taking nobody. And the fight ensued. It made the news. But again, remember, this is before cell phones and whatnot.
Right.
But I remember watching the news, and when the newsmen got there, they used a hog tie. Remember the hog tie back in the day?
No, I had a suspect die when I did that.
Yeah.
Of course,
He
was on cocaine and his heart exploded and he tried to kill his girlfriend 5 minutes earlier, but that's
a different story. It's still your fault, though.
It's still my fault. Well, exactly. I mean, I don't feel great about it, but I mean, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So I remember they had when the guy's hog tied, you know, but an officer had his arm broken. This was a full-blown fight.
Sure.
This was a fisticuffs.
A Donnybrook.
Exactly. This was straight up. And 3 weeks later, in the Athens district, I know you remember this, two deputies are driving along, and a car goes behind them, tailgates them, and pulls to the left, and poof, takes off. Deputies goes on a pursuit. And they followed this car to an apartment complex that was owned by the Nation of Islam. Deputies contact the driver. I believe he had a warrant. I can't remember. So anyway, they're going to take him into custody. No. The fight's on. They take the gun. The rookie off deputy, his gun was taken from him. But he had a secondary strapped to his ankle. So he took out his secondary, and he starts shooting. He kills one of them, you know. So after those incidents, there was a meeting between law enforcement, head of law enforcement in the nation at the time. And there was an investigation. And it mentioned my incident at Galey and Wilshire and all the other incidents. And there was an agreement at the time between the Nation of Islam and law enforcement just to respect one another. And I can't remember any major incidents since then, you know, since the last one in the Athens district back in 1990.
I'm not really sure why they thought they were being disrespected. It was none of their business if you're writing a ticket, but that's another story.
It's another story. But the thing is, I look back on that incident now and with the female sergeant, and because our department and LAPD gave her a ration because she walked in the group. They could have taken her.
Sure.
You know, but as Detective Baker said, she did everything wrong, but it turned out to have been right. You know, it was a common effect.
Well, sometimes that happens.
Yeah, I'm 57 now. I'm happy that I didn't get into a Donnybrook with these guys.
That's right.
You know.
Helps if you're Irish if you get one of those, too. But just saying. We've only got about, 10 minutes left. Give me some more story. Give me another story. What's another favorite story of yours?
Well, I have another one.
You got about 30 stories later.
Oh, I have 33 chapters. I have another one. It's called The Spook of CHS.
The Spook of CHS.
The Spook of CHS. Right. Now, if you know
Center for Health Sciences.
Exactly.
UCLA Medical Center, the largest medical center at the time, west of Mississippi, 35 miles of hallways or something.
Exactly. It's large.
Yeah.
And if you ever, there was a book, The Spook is Set by the Door. It's a story about the first black CIA agent. Now, if the spook is nothing racial, CIA agents, if they work covert operations, are called spook.
Right.
Okay. So I was hired at UCLA to be an undercover officer to buy dope, cocaine, marijuana from a particular hospital employee who was selling narcotics. I had a named suspect. I'm not going to say his name. My job was to go get him, even if it took a year. My cover job was a clinical engineer.
Well, I got to play a doctor. I still got the badge and everything.
I still have my ID. Yeah. I was a clinical engineer. All and right. my and a clinical engineer, my job was to make sure that the electrical equipment to a patient were properly grounded.
Well, that's a very good job. That's a great job. Yeah. That's important, isn't it?
Even though I wasn't fully trained in it. But that,
oh, my God.
And I actually did. I actually performed those tests.
All right. Good.
I actually did.
Nobody got electrocuted. Their ventilators didn't turn off.
Can you imagine had I tested it and it thing to – oh, I don't even want to go there.
Yeah.
But anyway, I worked undercover, and I'm there about 8 employees. Okay.
8 of them. Wow.
Yeah. But
how long did that take?
It took me 6 months.
Okay.
But I had a connection to the Colombians. Remember, this is 1988-89, right. Okay? I had a connection to the Colombians, okay? And I wanted to take that connection on because they were based in the Hermosa and Redondo Beach area. And our UCLA said, no, we just want to get the people who are doing drugs here on campus. Why don't we drop these names off to DEA? No, because we'd still be part of it because they had to use you with – that made me very upset. I mean, okay, I'm just here just to get small fry. So anyway, I call that chapter The Spook of CHS. I love the fact that I worked undercover, but I'll never do it again.
How come?
Well, I became friends with these guys.
Well, that is the difficult part of
it,
right?
Yeah, I became friends. Yeah. Here's a real funny part of the story. There was one guy, his name was, call him Rock. He was a huge guy, big guy. And he was allegedly, I'm not going to say his name, but allegedly he was involved in loan sharking and drug sales. I tried to get him, but he would never do business with me. But he told me to my face he thought I was, what was that show that was on at the time with these undercover cops? 21 Jump Street.
He thought you were 21.
He said, you're 21. You said, you're 21. I said, you know, 21 Jump Street, you know. And I tried to act, you know, act the part. But he was going on spreading the word that I was possibly a police officer or gay, you know.
Police officer or gay?
Okay, yes.
Okay, I'm not sure what that connection is, but that's interesting, right?
Yeah. So I
but
went,
not a gay police officer.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I was gay or. So this is all true. This all happened. So I went to one of my handlers, and I said, "Look, this guy is spreading nonsense about me. Either I'm gay." Or I'm a cop. You got to give me a wife. Okay. They say, okay, we get your wife. A day later, they say, what kind of wife do you want? You want a black, white, Hispanic, or what?
How nice of them to ask you. It's nice work if you can get it.
Well, since my wife's name was Jasmine, I think it'd probably be hard to, you know, explain an Asian woman named Jasmine. So she said, well, we don't have a black. Okay. The next day, we don't have no black females available. We have a Asian or Greek. I said,
are these serious questions?
These are serious.
Who cares?
These are serious. But I already gave him a name as Jasmine, so we had to have someone look like Jasmine.
I guess. All right.
Okay. So I said, okay, give me the Greek. So they give me a Greek officer. She comes down from San Francisco, and I'm explaining to her, you see San Francisco.
Right.
And I'm explaining to her what they think of me, either being gay or being a cop. She kind of looked at me when I said gay. And I looked at her back. And I looked at her, are you gay? She said, yes. I said, this something?
So she didn't peg you for being gay. She figured she knew or something?
No, I figured.
She said, why? This guy's not gay, obviously. Is that what she thought? Or she thought the opposite?
No. When I said gay, she was almost offended by it. You know, by me.
Oh.
Yeah. So. And then I thought, into some, I want to prove to these guys that I ain't gay or a cop, and they sent me someone who was gay. So she played the part wonderfully. We went to a party together, and she played my wife, You know,
what did your wife think about another wife, by the way?
She thought it was hilarious.
Oh, that's good. Good sport.
My wife is a trooper in this. I mean, not just a cop's wife, but a Marine wife. When I got activated to go overseas, the local media came and interviewed us at the unit. She didn't cry. All she said is, hey, my Marines and my husband, they had to go over there and do what they got to do. You know, and he come back home. That was her. That's her mentality.
Yeah, that that hospital, people don't realize how busy it is. Yeah. And all the weird stuff that goes on. I had a case where we had a guy that was in charge of all the janitors, right?
Uh-huh.
And if you worked on a graveyard and you wanted to get on day shift, yeah, you had to pay him $2,000 to change your shift.
Yes.
And then if you that was bad enough, right?
Right.
Then he hired vapor employees.
Right.
Meaning he hires Terry Dern, and Terry Dern doesn't even exist.
Right.
And all we found dozens of addresses on these employees' paychecks all going back to his house.
Okay.
So he'd hire a fake employee and put them on the books and say they'd work 12 hours and send the money to his house. It was a big deal. We only got a few minutes left, and I want you to kind of give us an idea and a sense of, you know, would you recommend law enforcement now? Would you not? Just a couple of minutes, and we gotta go off, and we'll talk about all your books being sold and stuff. But what it's changed, isn't it? It's different.
It's changed now. An officer could do everything correct and still get hammered.
That's right. Doesn't matter what you do. Follow the book, and that's it. You're sued. You're in trouble. You're in
trouble. You're in jail, and that sort of thing. So I tell someone, look here, if you want to go into law enforcement, really pick and choose if you can what department you want to go on to. And if you get on the department, understand the policy and the procedures to the hilt. Okay. And also make sure you have a strong POA. Make sure you have a strong legal defense at your department, you know, because, again, you could do everything right and your department heads could basically throw you under the bus.
Right.
You know, and that's a fact. You know, I would recommend also go to feds, you know, U.S. Postal Inspectors, DEA, FBI. There's plenty of other federal agencies that I never even heard of. They exist.
Now, why do you say feds instead of local stuff?
Well, again, when as uniformed police officers, we contact a lot of people that we don't know who they are in the beginning.
Right.
Well, with them, at least they have a named suspect that they can go and get. You know, you're a postal inspector, you're doing an investigation.
More detective work.
More detective work.
That's true. There's more detective work.
Detective type work. As opposed to you're in a blue uniform and you're doing a traffic stop on someone and you don't know who you're doing a traffic stop on.
Right.
You know, I had a guy, this is about a year before I retired. He gets out of the car, and I had to tell him to get back in the car. And he started walking towards me. I told him, I'm going to shoot you, man. Get your butt back in the car. And he got back in the car. Luckily, everything was on tape because it had a dashboard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
You know, so, you know, things like that, you know. So,
the book is, let me pull up the book here for everybody. We'll get a picture of it real quick. I'm the head engineer and bottle washer here right now, so it's a little hard to get these shots. So. Right here, the book is University Sheepdog in Westwood, Los Angeles. See a picture right there. That's by my pal Terrence Duren. And you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Google. Where else? Barnes & Noble,
Noble, yeah, Barnes & Noble.
Saw some reviews, right? 600 pages. I didn't get to read it. I've been really busy. I will read it. But I have to take Valium probably before I read it. I'm probably going to get really upset.
Well, there's 33 chapters, and they're all independent chapters, and they all independent stories. So you can read one or two chapters, you know, and then you actually don't even have to start at the first chapter. You could just start at any chapter, and each chapter is independent.
Independent story.
Independent story, yeah.
Terry, I'm very proud of you, man.
Thank you.
And especially since you made it out of that nut house.
I made it. I'm blessed.
You are.
Yes, I am.
That's excellent. All right, well, everybody tune in next week to securityguidetv.com or securityguideradio.com on your phone, internet, and livestream.com. And Terry, again, thanks for coming. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
All right. Good night, everybody.